Okay, hi everybody. Welcome to my presentation. It's called Patterns and Practices Preview. Thank you for being here and not going to Scott Goo's presentation, which is probably also going to be very nice. Unlike what's mentioned in the booklet you received today, this presentation is going to be in English. Hope that's not going to be a problem for anybody. In this presentation, we're going to do something really, really cool. We are going to predict the future. Now, predicting the future is something that could be really, really helpful. For example, a fallen victim, please. You. How did you get here today?
By
public transit. All right. Now, what would you have done if you would have heard today that there was going to be a huge strike and you couldn't reach this by public transport?
Go by car,
right. So what you're going to do is you're going to prepare for future events. If you know what's coming, you can prepare for it. Another thing might be, what would you have done if you would have heard that there was going to be a huge accident on the train, right? And, you know, you heard about that, that there's going to be an accident. What would you do?
Warn people.
Exactly. If you know what the future is going to bring, you can change the future for your and possibly other people's benefit as well. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to look at some of the future patterns and practices projects. And I have two goals for this presentation. One is to prepare you guys for those future releases. Because if you know what's coming up, then you can prepare for it. Then you can take advantage of those projects. And secondly, Patterns and Practices, as we'll soon learn, is an organization which really uses feedback from everybody. So if you know what's coming up, you can help to shape those releases to your benefit, to be able to change the future for the better. So that's going to be the subject of today's presentation. Right. Now, in order to do that, I'm going to talk about a couple things. For these projects, I'm going to tell you when these projects are likely to start and when they're likely to finish. I'm also going to tell you who's responsible for these projects. And usually it's the project manager or the lead developer on the team. But those guys are really keen on customer feedback. So if there's something that you would like in those projects, they would love to hear your feedback on it. So take advantage of that when I mention their names. And of course, I'm going to tell you where you can find more about these projects. Now, unfortunately, due to time constraints, because I'm going to talk about quite a bunch of projects, I can't really go into depth about these projects. But so we're not going to look at code or anything, but I am going to tell you, as much as I can within the given time frame. Now, there are some risks associated with predicting the future. First of all, it's not very easy to predict the future. If you look at weather predictions, for example, well, with pretty good accuracy, a weather guy can predict today's weather, maybe tomorrow's weather. But, 10, 15 days from now? I once heard a prediction from a weather guy who said, well, there's going to be a 50% chance of unsure weather patterns. What does that mean, right? Now, the same holds for these predictions that I'm going to do today. I mean, with pretty good accuracy, I can say, these projects are currently underway. They're likely going to ship this month, next month. But some projects are a bit unclear when they're going to start, when they're going to end. But that's not a problem. It's actually something that could be used by your benefit, because those projects that are further in the future could be influenced more. I mean, if a project has already almost completed, all that you can say is it's good or it's not as good, but it's very difficult to influence them. But if you know what's coming in the bit further future, you have more chances to influence them. And secondly, what if this guy walks up to you and says, hey, psst, I know what the future is going to bring. Would you believe that? Well, probably not, right? Now, I do hope that I'm a bit more reliable than that character over there. But so my name is Erwin van der Volk. I'm a freelance software developer and architect. And about 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I used to work for Patterns and Practices in Redmond. Right now, I moved back to Holland and I'm working as a freelancer. But still, occasionally, I do a project for Patterns and Practices. And I know the PMs quite well. And before this presentation, I had some interviews with them. So I kind of know what's coming up. But I'm not a Microsoft employee anymore, so I can't speak for them and can't be held accountable either. Now, I'm sometimes a bit schizophrenic because if I talk about patterns and practices, sometimes I say we and sometimes I say them, just because of my history. But I mean them if I talk about we or us, or this is how we do things, right? All right. Now, this is going to be the agenda for today. First of all, I'm just going to introduce patterns and practices a little bit, tell you what they do, how they do it, and what makes them tick. And then there are six projects that I'd like to talk to you guys. The first four, you know, with quite a lot of surety, I can tell you about what they're doing, what's going on. But the last two are a bit more vague. They're a bit more in the future. But I still think it's valuable to mention them and to talk about them. So first of all, patterns and practices. Who knows patterns and practices quite well in this room? Hands? Okay, so there's a couple people who know them, who've used them. Patterns and practices is a team within Microsoft. It's not a product team or anything. It's a group of developers, architects, and documentation writers that try and give guidance on how to build software. Their slogan is proven practices for predictable results. They used to call them best practices, but calling something a best practice is really dependent on the situation you're in. So that's why they're saying now proven practices, which means it's been tried and tested and looks like it gives really good results. So in my own words, what does patterns and practices do? They are there to help make you more successful as a developer or architect on the Microsoft platform. So they don't sell anything. Well, I think you can buy some of their books, but other than that, I think you can just download most of them as well. I mean, all the software that they write is open source. They give it away to you. They write documentation, they write hands-on labs, just a whole bunch of guidance to help you make better software. And that's actually quite valuable because for Microsoft as well, I mean, because a product team primary goal is to sell software. And hopefully they'll sell you something that you actually might want to use and that makes you happy. But patterns and practices tries to, you know, really make you get the best out of the software. And by doing that, hopefully you'll become a more happy Microsoft customer and, you know, get more return business. Now, the way that they do that is by demonstrating and explaining proven practices. So they go out into the community. They ask around, okay, what works, what doesn't? And that's what they try and put in some guidance. And essentially, if you look at it, the tools that the product team build, like Visual Studio, like Windows, they're all tools. And depending on how you use them, you can use them, you know, very effectively, or you can use them quite poorly, actually. So depending on those practices, you know, you get a certain result. And that's where they're trying to guide you. And lastly, they use currently available technology. So that means is that when a new technology comes out, typically after that is when they start a project to give guidance on it. And that kind of means also is that they don't use the bleeding edge technology. So you'll likely not find right now some guidance on Windows 8, for example, because, you know, there's no proven practices out there yet. So let's take a quick look at how patterns and practices does a project, because I think that can help you understand what kind of guidance patterns and practices can give and what kind of, you know, software they can write for you. Usually they work in quite small teams, between 3 and 10 persons. That's quite different from, for example, a product team who might have hundreds of people working on a project. And the project for patterns and practices typically takes around 2 to 6 months, and 6 months is actually a really long project. So these two added up mean that they don't have a huge bandwidth of delivering guidance. So what they try and do is ask the community, what kind of guidance do you need? And that's what they try and focus on. So that's really important in how they work. Now, they have quite close contact with product teams because they are essentially all Microsoft employees. So what they do is when they want to give guidance on a certain topic, they go to that product team and they ask them, okay, what was your intent with this piece of software? How do you think it should be used? That's not always the way that they actually, you know, tell them how to use things, because the product team might have a vision which doesn't really work in practice. But that's why they have an advisor board for every project, an advisor board of subject matter experts. Now, those are people who are very active in that particular space, usually MVPs or just people who are working for companies that use that particular technology, or and around, depending, sometimes 4, 10 advisors. And every 2 weeks, they have an advisor board meeting where those advisors come together and just discuss the plans. Okay, this is what's been released so far. What do you think? Is it good? Is it bad? Should we change something? And also, this is what we're planning on doing for the next 2, 3 weeks. What do you think? Is that valuable? Should we do something else? So that's one way of getting these proven practices. Another way of getting feedback from the community is by doing frequent public drops. So what they do is every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, typically they put a drop out on the internet that contains the source code, that contains all the documentation that has been written up until that point. And those are excellent points in time for you guys to have a look, see what's coming up, and do you like it? Does it work? Doesn't it work? Now, there are also quite a number of places where they go and collect feedback from the community. For example, for Enterprise Library, each time a new Enterprise Library project starts, there's a survey out that asks people, what are the top things that you think are important? And you can add your own topics there as well. And people can vote what are the things that they would like to address. Now, there are also the forums, for example, on CodePlex, where people can ask questions, report problems. And those are also excellent ways for Patterson practices to get feedback out of the community. Now, after a Patterson practice project has finished, it's not, you know, shrink-wrapped, packaged, deployed, and, you know, forgotten. But there's a sustaining engineering team that looks at, for example, the CodePlex forums to see if there are questions or problems. And if there are, you know, bugs that really need to be fixed, they'll go out and do it. If it's just, you know, minor inconveniences, they'll try and explain a workaround. But there is a sustaining engineering team which will help with solving any problems that you might have. Now, PMP is a really, how you call it, they have a certain mindset. They have certain core values that they really try and put into every piece of guidance that they give. And I think it's important to mention those. First of all, who knows the solid principles here? Excellent. A couple people. The solid principles were written by Robert Martin. He wrote about a couple of principles in software development that will really help building more maintainable software. For example, the single responsibility principle, which states that a single class should only have one reason to change. Because if you violate that principle, that means that you're putting too much functionality into a single class. And that means that it becomes very difficult to maintain. Now, there's a bunch of other. I mean, each letter stands for something. Like, for example, the D is dependency injection principle. But you will notice that every piece of software that Patterson Practices writes tries to follow these principles. Unit testing is another really, really important thing that Patterson Practices believes in. They really think that if you start writing, for example, using test-driven development methodologies, is that you will end up with better software. So if it's not, if it's a library or an RI or maybe just a code example, they will try and write that using test-driven development techniques. And that's not always easy because, for example, recently or quite a while ago, I worked on a SharePoint guidance project, and the SharePoint team has a different has different values with regards to testing and the way that software should be written. So you can tell that those values don't really match and that it's very difficult to actually build software that follows these patterns or these principles. Another thing that PMP is really advocate about is agile development technologies or practices. So they will have short iterations, like 2 to 3 weeks are typical, sometimes 1 week iterations. They will use continuous integration builds. They will, again, unit testing. All those agile development practices is they live them. And of course, the proven practices. They don't want to just be a cowboy and say, hey, this looks like a nice way of solving it. And those practices really have to be tried and tested by people before they try and, you know, put them out as guidance. And also, I mentioned it before, community-driven. Is they really need community feedback. They need feedback from everybody here, you know, to make a better product. So that's also one of the reasons why I'm giving a presentation like this, is to try and involve the Dutch developer community into, you know, more involvement with Patterson Practices. So I've talked a bit about, okay, what makes PMP. Now let's look a bit at the past. Okay. Now this is a picture of a, you know, old structure. We don't really know what it was for, but it's huge and it's been there for a while. Patterns and Practices has some monoliths from the past, I think. One of them, the .NET Application Architecture Guide, written, I think, somewhere around 2000. It's a pretty good book, actually. It described, you know, at the time how to use .NET to write applications. I thought it was really handy, but, you know, right now it's a bit out of date. Who knows the application blocks before Enterprise Library came out? Yeah, well, I mean, they were a good start at addressing some of the cross-cutting concerns that you might run into if you're developing software. For example, logging, for example, data access. Software factories, anybody use those? Just one person? Right. Well, the software factories were a really good idea. I mean, there are some practices that patterns and practices thought were really valuable, like, you know, test-driven development, like model view presenter patterns, those kind of things. But unfortunately, trying to make actionable guidance within Visual Studio was a lot more difficult than we had hoped. So what you'd find is that those software factories try to help you setting things up, like setting up a test project, setting up presenters and those kind of things. But it relied very much on code generators to hide complexity, and it didn't really work out as well. This is also, I think, one of the reasons why sometimes people see patterns and practices as giving, you know, quite complex guidance. Because especially in this point in time when the software factories came out, and I think Enterprise Library 2 or 3 also came out, is there was quite a heavy emphasis on, you know, on complex software. And I think that was a bit of a problem. Now, you'll see that right now and in the future, they're trying to move away from a bit of those complexities and trying to make it a bit more down to earth so that everybody can take more advantage of the guidance that they give. But still, you know, trying to address those same problems. So right now, there's a whole bunch of deliverables from patterns and practices which are, you know, still very relevant. There's a new version of the Application Architecture Guide. There's guidance on anything from SharePoint, from composite applications, websites, Windows Phone, you name it. There's guidance on it right now. And you'll see that as the platform evolves, that these things will get revved continuously. All right, so now we're going to look at some of the future PMP projects. That's actually, you know, what we were here for. There's 6 projects that I'd like to talk to you about, and some we're just going to mention, okay, this is what's coming up, nothing, and some I'm going to talk a bit more about. So the first project is going to be Prism. Has anybody used Prism here? A couple hands. Well, Prism, it's one of my personal favorite, actually. It's the composite guidance for WPF and Silverlight. And what that means is that it will help you to create a user interface that consists of modules. So instead of making one big monolithic application where every DLL is referencing each other, you can build a user interface that consists of discrete modules. And at runtime, you plug these modules in your shell, and all kinds of user interface elements start to appear, and things loosely couple, or communicate loosely coupled with each other. It's really, really good guidance on how to build WPF and Silverlight applications. Now, this is the example application that ships with it. And it might be a bit difficult to see, but there's like it's a stock trader application, and there's pieces like, okay, this is the value of your current stock. This is some news, comes from a different module. You can buy and sell, again, which comes from a different module. And everything just plugs together into a UI that forms a single piece. But the latest version of Prism was released in November 2010 that targeted Silverlight 4. Got quite a bunch of downloads. A lot of people really liked it. But right now, as some of you might know, Silverlight 5 is out. And that's what Prism 4.1 is going to target. It's actually a really small project. As soon as Silverlight 5 came out, what we did was we just took the source code, compiled it against Silverlight 5, ran a bunch of tests, and it all worked already. But packaging it up and making sure that it's a real release takes quite a bit of effort within Microsoft. So they had to rev up a small project for it. And of course, if you're going to rev it up anyway, I mean, it's a good point to do some bug fixes in it as well. So that's what Prism 4.1 is going to be. Just a compiled version against Silverlight 5. Yeah, go ahead.
Is it a separate tool or is it a library that you include?
Okay, so it's a library that you can use that helps you to build those composite applications. And there's also a whole set of guidance on composite application patterns and how you can build up an application so that it consists of these discrete modules that, for example, can be discovered at runtime, but also can be compiled against. And the previous versions used Unity as their bridge between that. The latest version, Prism 4, uses Meth also. I mean, you can still use Unity as a dependency injection, but to kind of put the glue together. The core of it is actually kind of a region framework, where if I go back to this slide here, you can mark certain areas in your screen as regions, and then using a library, you can say, okay, well, plug this piece of UI in here, plug this piece of UI in here, and also if you have two modules that need to communicate together, there's an event broker between them, so you can send a message out saying, hey, for example, an order was submitted, and then other modules can pick up, okay, if an order was submitted, then I will do this. And they will take care of everything like the reference counting and whatnot. It's one of my favorite pieces, actually. Now, so let's look at who, when, and where for this project. It could be released anytime now. I know that the PM who's, or the lead dev who's working on this is just wrapping up the final thing. So if it's not today, it's going to be next week. Bob Brumfield is going to be the, or is the PM on this. He also was the lead dev who built most of the previous versions. This is where you can find him. It's his blog. He's a really nice guy, very open. So if there's anything you feel about Prism, feel free to ping him. He's a really great guy. And you can find Prism on Codeplex. That's the latest version, and I'm pretty sure that the next version is going to be there as well. Now, there are plans for Prism 4.5. I couldn't really get any good feel on what Prism 4.5 is really going to be about. But they're going to look at Windows 8 and see, okay, well, Windows 8 also does something with WPF-like technology, XAML, and it might be a rev for the new things that are coming up in Windows 8, but they couldn't or wouldn't tell me anything about it. Only that, if something like that comes out, it will probably ship just shortly after Windows 8 ships. So, sorry, can't tell really that much more about Prism 4.5. Okay, the next project that I'd like to talk to you about is going to be the Windows Azure Guidance V3. This V3 already says there's been two other versions before that. The first version, V1, was called Moving Applications to the Cloud. Now, what they did there was, at that point in time, Windows Azure was relatively new. So what they did is they said, okay, well, if you have an existing web application, how can I move that to the cloud and just gently start taking advantage of all the bits and pieces that are in Windows Azure? For example, when should you use the queues? When should you use Azure tables? Those kind of things. What does it cost is also, of course, an interesting thing, which they described in that guidance. The second version of developing applications for the cloud, was called developing applications for the cloud, that took a more greenfield scenario. And greenfield means I'm just going to build a brand new application that takes advantage of all the things that are available to me as a Windows Azure developer. And what they did is they built a multi-tenant application that runs on Windows Azure, and they mentioned all the problems and the challenges that you run into if you're building a multi-tenant application in Windows Azure. But now it's up to V3. And V3 targets a bit more enterprise or a bit larger corporations. Because what they're saying is, if you're in an enterprise organization and you have lots of applications already running in your own data center or your own server farm, then if you want to start taking advantage of cloud, you might want to have those applications communicate together. You want to integrate them. There are their own set of challenges with that. Now, if this is what you build your applications like, this is actually a picture I took from the Daily WTF. Then you have a problem, obviously, because there's way, way too many dependencies in this chart. But if you build your applications like one huge monolith, then it's very difficult to just move pieces of that into the cloud. Just probably not possible. So, but if you're using a service-oriented architecture, then that's probably going to be much, much easier. Because you can just take one piece of that service-oriented architecture and start moving that into the cloud. And after that, you can go on to the next piece. Now, this is, of course, what this guidance is trying to explain to you, how to move these pieces over to the cloud. But there are certain challenges with that. For example, if you were used to doing all your authentication and authorization with, for example, Active Directory, then that all of a sudden doesn't work anymore when your applications are running in the cloud. Now, there are, of course, ways to solve that, for example, with claims-based authentication, but it's a challenge that you need to address. Another one is cross-boundary communication. Well, quite often, you know, these organizations, they have, you know, very strict firewall rules, and it's not just allowed to just access all kind of back-end applications from the internet, which is essentially what's happening if you start moving things to the cloud. So how are you going to solve that problem in an enterprise? Now, there's also challenges with message routing. Monitoring and management is something that I ran into quite often. If you have your applications all monitored, but locally in your own data center, you know, that has its own challenges. But as soon as you start moving them between different data centers, well, then monitoring and managing them can become really a problem. Data synchronization is another one of those challenges, especially, you know, if you have data that is accessed really, really often within your application, then, you know, synchronizing them between two different sites has its own challenges. Now, this is the roadmap that Patterns & Practices has written up for, or the table of contents, actually, for the guidance. There's going to be a book and a reference application that describes how to solve all of these challenges. And the reference implementation is going to tackle a whole bunch of technologies. You'll see here, like Azure Connect, to have a, you know, on-premise database that you might want to connect to from the cloud, or a traffic manager to have two geographically located parts of your application, but still, you know, having them work as a single application. And this is actually something that PMP really, really, adds value, I think, because all these technologies are written by the product teams, and they, you know, have certain vision with these technologies. But what Patterns & Practices does is they take all these technologies and then they'll just sit down and say, okay, now let's build an application that uses all of this. And sometimes it's very, very easy, and sometimes it's actually really, really hard. But, you know, in the end, they usually, especially with help of trusted advisors and with help of the community, they come up with solutions to all of these problems, and they describe the pros and cons of different solutions and different approaches. So this is much more an end-to-end example than, you know, the individual solutions that you can find on product team sites or something. Now, this guidance is pretty much in a final state as well. I mean, it's supposed to ship somewhere in March 2012. The PM is Masashi Namamoto. He's a relatively new guy for Patterns & Practices. This is his blog. This is where you can find his email address as well and where you can ping him. And you can find this information on wag.coplex.com. If there are any other questions, by the way, just feel free to interrupt me. I mean, not a problem at all. Okay. So the third project that I'd like to look at is the web guidance project. It's called Blikey. I thought it was a Norwegian name or something for movement. Well, kind of fits with mobile web application development. The approach that they took with this project is they took a scenario, Contoso Automotive in this particular scenario. And Contoso Automotive is or has a web application that you can use to just measure car fuel efficiency. This is based on a previous project, the regular web guidance project. That's where they built this this example application. But given an application like this, which is just a regular browser web application, but then very rich, you know, with lots of JavaScript, lots of interactivity, this really doesn't work very well on mobile devices. And also, the way that you use a mobile application is typically very different than the way that you would use an application on a desktop or a laptop. So what Contoso Automotive wants to do is, okay, they want to build a new website that's a mobile web application that people can use to measure their car fuel efficiency, but center it about, you know, the device-based user experience. So that means, you know, I'm sitting in my car, I'm taking out my mobile device, and for example, I want to track, you know, how far I've ridden, and then, you know, enter how much fuel I've used and calculate some things based on location, for example. That's going to be different than their regular web application that they already have. But also, I mean, they don't want to really, you know, throw away their entire code base and just start over again, because that's, you know, something that is just very hard to sell to the business. So they want to reuse as much code as they can and still provide, you know, a very good user experience to both their mobile and their regular website. Now, how do they do this? Well, at first, again, they started with a survey on uservoice.com. The survey is still out there. You can still vote on it. Most of the things that they're tackling are already, you know, the things with the most votes. But you can still go there and vote on some things. And if there's enough votes on a certain subject, I'm pretty sure that they're going to address that as well. But these are some of the things that they're giving guidance on right now. Previously, you know, a while back, if you were building a web application, you would ask the web application, oh, are you, for example, an IE6 browser or, you know, a Firefox browser? And based on that information, you would kind of guess, okay, well, this browser can do this or this browser can do that. But there seems to be a tendency to move away from, you know, browser detection and more on device capability detection. So, for example, does this device, you know, can this device know where it is? Does it have, you know, geotagging capabilities? And they're going to give guidance on how to use that in your mobile web applications. And also, there's all these mobile web frameworks out there, like, for example, jQuery Mobile or other web frameworks. And they're going to look at, okay, what kind of value do these frameworks add, and how would you apply them in your own web application? And speaking of those frameworks, I mean, how much JavaScript is actually, you know, valuable on a web client, on a mobile web client? I mean, should you just, you know, make it as rich as possible, or should you stay away from that and try and just make it work? It's the wow versus work factor. But they'll try and give some guidance on, like, all right, this would be a good level of you know, JavaScript on a client to still keep it maintainable, still keep it, you know, functioning correctly on different devices, but still giving a very good user experience. Now, this is also something that I think is very valuable. How do you do pre-production testing? I mean, when building regular websites, I already found it difficult to test my web application on every different browser that was out there. But now with mobile devices, I mean, there's so much variation on what these devices can support. Different versions of the operating system, different versions of, you know, the browsers that are on there. So how do you do pre-production testing with, for example, you know, emulators or something? Although going to give some guidance around how to do that as well. And there's other topics like optimizing payload or supporting non-HTML5 browsers. There's a bunch of other features out there that just had less votes, so I just took the ones that they're already working on. But if this is an area that you're interested in, you know, go there and vote, because you can still, you know, influence it a little bit. Now, this will ship end of March 31st. So based on my gut feeling, there's about a 2 or 3 week period that you can still vote, and that might still go into the application or in the reference application. So it still is very valuable to just go there and have a look and vote. Now, the PM for this project was Don Smith. Really great guy. Unfortunately, this week is his last week at PMP and the last week at Microsoft. He moved to New Zealand. So he's being replaced by the lead dev, Christopher Benage. You can find his blog here. He's also very active and, you know, very active in the space. So feel free to ping him with questions or requests as well. I mean, he doesn't mind, I hope. No. You can find this project not on CodePlex, but on GitHub. It's on likey.github.com. All right. The next one is a really interesting one. This project is called A Journey to CQRS. It's about the command query and responsibility segregation. 5 points if you detect a spelling error. Anyway, this pattern is starting to gain more and more momentum, especially within cloud applications. So traditionally, if you wanted to build an application, this is kind of like how you would do it, right? You take a database, you have your model or your application model that sits on top of that database that has your business logic in it, and you have a user interface on top of that which interacts with your application model to do certain things. Read data, write data, validate certain input. Now, what CQRS mentions is they define a separation between your read model and your write model. And those should be as separate as possible. Now, you might wonder, you know, why would I do that? When would I want to apply a pattern like this? Well, my gut feeling always says that if you're building an application that does massively more reads than writes, then the CQRS pattern might be able to help you with something. For example, if you're building a blog engine or a blogging system, well, even if you're a very active blogger, well, if you're a very active blogger that just blogs to himself, probably not, but if you're just an active blogger, hopefully you'll have many more reads on your system than writes. Or if you have a system like an e-commerce site where you just, you know, lots of people are reading the stuff that you sell, but, you know, only a few orders come in, then having a different read system from a different write system might be helpful. Because what does it allow you to do? Well, for example, it allows you to split up your databases, where you have a separate database for writing stuff in and maintaining your state, and a separate database for reading certain stuff, reading information. And of course, there's going to be some synchronization going on there, but this can really help, for example, your scalability. And again, that's really important for cloud applications, because their scaling up and down is really important. And if you have only one database that contains your, you know, single version of the truth, you can't really scale that up very easily. It can also simplify your domain logic, so that logic that sits in the middle, because reading, especially if you're doing paging and, you know, more complex querying logic, that might complicate your domain logic. So splitting up these responsibilities can make sense in certain situations. And, well, if you're working with immutable data, for example, like audit information or just tracking changes which are going on in your system, then this pattern can also be very effective. But there is a problem with this pattern, and that is that it's relatively new, and it's still not very widely understood. I mean, how many people know the CQRS pattern here? There's just a couple hands, maybe four or five. Another problem with this pattern is that, well, CRUD is really well understood. I mean, everybody who's a bit of a software developer knows how to do a CRUD-like system, but building your entire application based on CQRS, there should be a really good advantage to that by doing that, because, you know, it's just going to be more difficult to maintain if you really don't know the pattern that well. So this is also why it's not called the definitive guidance on CQRS. What patterns and practices wants to do is they're going to take this pattern and just build an example application on top of that. Well, they already have a bunch of advisors that can be used or that are very, you know, familiar in this space, and they've used this pattern a lot. But together with those advisors, they're going to just try and build an application that does this. And as they're doing that, they're going to see, okay, well, what worked well? What didn't work well? And they're going to document everything, their entire journey as they were implementing the CQRS pattern. Now, that might mean that they ran into a dead end and it wasn't really, you know, they had to back off, redo certain things, and all of that will probably go into the book that they're writing as well. And it's not so much the end result. I mean, the end result will be, you know, a very well-working implementation of CQRS, but it's much more the learnings. Okay, when should you use this pattern? When shouldn't you? When should you steer away from it? And, you know, just a attempt to get more clarity in this space. Again, now this project is already underway. It will probably ship somewhere in June 2012. So if you're really interested in this, I mean, there's plenty of opportunity to just, you know, influence this project, to have a look at what they're doing. The PM is Grigory Melnik. He's a really great guy. He also does the Enterprise Library projects as well. You can find him here. He's a very active blogger. He really doesn't mind pinging him about, you know, anything that you might feel about this pattern or what you might think would be interested. And they just launched a website, cqrsjourney.github.com. There's not really that much there because they just launched this website, I think, 2 days ago. But this is where you can have a look to for everything that they're doing in this space. So they'll put all their source code out there, all their documentation, and they'll describe their journey. Hope it will be an interesting journey. I think it will be. All right. Windows 8 developer guidance. I mean, this is one that I had really big hopes on. I mean, when I mentioned this as a presentation subject, I said, I wanted to have a talk about this. And when I came to the PM, he said, well, It's not that much I can tell you about it. Sorry. Okay. Well, why not? I mean, well, we'll get to that. So Windows 8, I mean, you've probably already seen build conference, all the slides. I mean, there's going to be really, really cool things that we can start building with Windows 8, with Windows RT. And, you know, they built a whole new runtime. Well, it's not whole new. I mean, it really maps, of course, close to Silverlight and the already CLR. But there's lots of new namespaces, lots of new objects that you can interact with. And if you're new to developing, you know, applications on Windows 8, which probably everybody's going to be, well, I would like some guidance on what works well in this space, what doesn't work well, and how to approach that. So that's why they've already started this project, but they didn't want to tell much about it. This is pretty much all the information that I could get what they're doing right now. It's going to be, you know, build an end-to-end sample in Windows 8 that will, you know, explain all the bits and pieces or all the important things that are happening with Windows 8 development. For example, when to choose, you know, HTML5 or when to use XAML and how to get them to interact really well, those kind of things. But, yeah, it's a bit difficult for PMP to start, you know, mingling in this space because, well, the CTP is probably coming in, you know, February 29th. The RTM is going to be in July, November. That doesn't really match very well with proven practices and predictable results, right? Well, fortunately, they do have a bunch of advisors who have access to some of those builds and who are, you know, working with that very closely. But if you are very interested about Windows 8 development and, you know, you're maybe planning on doing something there and maybe having something ready as soon as Windows 8 launches as well, this might be a really handy project to have a look at and, you know, to yell about. So to ping PMP about saying, hey, this is what I feel that is important. Now, some things that you can think about, you know, what kind of guidance would you want? For example, you know, do you need guidance on which language to use and, you know, what the benefits of each language are? Or, you know, think about the composite guidance that we talked about, you know, Prism. Would you like a Prism version that, you know, is really focused on Windows 8? I mean, if that's what's important to you, tell them. Or, you know, interop between Windows 7 and Windows 8. If you have a, you know, good selling Windows 7 application and you would like to say, okay, now I want to have a similar version on Windows 8, well, how can you do that with, you know, reusing as much code base as you can? Well, if that's something that you're really passionate about, tell them. I mean, that will definitely help. So when is this project going to start? Well, I mean, the first announcement is likely going to be right after CDP. He wouldn't tell me, but I could look in his eyes and get the feeling that that's when the first announcements of this project are going to come up and what they've built so far. The release is likely going to be shortly after RTM, whenever that's going to be. I don't know. The PM for this project is Blaine Westell. You know, feel free to ping him, send him emails, spam him about what you think is important. Not a problem at all. And there's no site yet for this project because they're still waiting for the CDP to appear. So the PMP site is where you can find information when this project really starts or is available. Okay, the last project I'd like to talk to you guys about is Enterprise Library 6. Who here is using Enterprise Library 5 right now? There's a bunch of hands. The PM of Enterprise Library asked me to take a picture when there was hands. So, yeah. I'd like to do that as well. So first, really the people who are using it, and then just to bug him. So, sorry, my camera's a bit slow. It's Android, so that's the problem, right? Okay. So now everybody's hands, please, just for fun. Yeah. It's slow, so I'm still taking the picture. Yeah. There it is. Thank you very much. That will bug the hell out of him. I'll just say who doesn't know Enterprise Library and he'll get really pissed off. But then he won't hire me for the next project, so that's, no, I don't know. I'll see what works. Anyway, Enterprise Library 6 is going to come up, and when I said I'm going to talk about this, the PM said don't. I was like, okay, why not? But I can't help it. I mean, so I try to get as much information what I can about this project. Well, this is what I think Enterprise Library does, really. When .NET came out, I mean, it was really a great library. Did a whole bunch of things, but there are also lots of areas where .NET really didn't shine. For example, the first version, the logging, diagnostic, was really bad. I mean, data access, you could access data, but really was pretty horrible to do that in .NET. So Enterprise Library tried to take on these challenges and, you know, build reusable blocks that you could use for these common problems in the software development. So, yeah, for me, the goal was to boldly go where .NET hasn't gone before. But the same problem with real science fiction is that, you know, the real world catches up with science fiction. I mean, lots of things that you see in Star Trek are already possible. Of course, not, you know, space travel and whatnot, but the way that they interact with computers, you know, holograms are already possible. I mean, what's going to be next? So this is the same problem that's going on with something like Enterprise Library. So the goals for Enterprise Library 6 are going to be to realign with the new .NET platform, to make sure that there's going to be a whole bunch of things in the .NET platform as it's going to be that, you know, make certain pieces in Enterprise Library obsolete. So what they're going to do is they're going to trim that down to reduce the footprint by just removing the pieces that you don't need anymore and to take advantage of new features. For example, maybe the async stuff. If you want to do stuff asynchronously with the Enterprise Library, I'm pretty sure that they're going to, you know, put that in Enterprise Library 6. And another thing that the PM did tell me is that it's really going to target Windows 8. So if you're going to build Windows 8 applications, then you can probably use Enterprise Library 6 to take advantage of, you know, all the goodness that that Enterprise Library offers, but when building Windows 8 applications. But there is a problem with that, of course, is that Windows 8 isn't out yet, so it really doesn't make much sense to start this project already. So originally, the plan was to start Enterprise Library 6 next month, so beginning of March. But also due to budget constraints and other things, the project's not going to start until July 2012. And, you know, before that, you can be damn sure that there's going to be a survey out on, well, it's again Grigory Melnik who's the PM for this project. But you can be damn sure that there's going to be a survey out on nlib.uservoice.com to ask everybody, and I hope you guys as well, you know, what do you want in the next version of Enterprise Library? And I also press on people, tell them what you don't like, you know, spam them with emails, because Enterprise Library still is one of the major, you know, products from PMP that they sell, I mean, or ship. They have only over 3.5 million downloads for Enterprise Library, so it's being used a lot worldwide. And I'm sure that they want to know, you know, what works and what doesn't work, so, you know, let them know. There's still quite some time left, so I'd like to, you know, press on everybody here that PMP is not here, you know, to sell stuff. I mean, PMP is here to help everybody here to become better. So take advantage of that. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's coming at us. It's really, really important. So, yeah, take advantage of that. But also, I'd like to impress on you that you can help PMP as well. You can influence what they are building. And, you know, I put this horrible, horrible American picture on there because if you are really passionate about a certain subject, you know, and are willing to be very vocal about that subject, you can also join the advisory board for certain projects. So let me know or let the PM know that you are really, you know, passionate and experienced in a certain area, and yeah, you can join the advisory board. You know, it doesn't earn you any money, but other than, you know, eternal fame when your name comes on the list of, you know, contributors of, you know, for example, Enterprise Library or something. But, you know, we're always looking for good advisors that can help, you know, with these things. So, and like I said, there's lots of new stuff that's interesting that's coming. I couldn't even, you know, talk about all of them. There's another bunch of projects like, you know, acceptance guiding or testing and guidance that's coming up that I couldn't even address in this presentation. And, you know, that's pretty much it. I mean, this is my blog. If you want to contact me or, you know, with questions, you know, with feedback on patterns and practices stuff, I mean, I can forward it to the right PM if you can't find him. You know, just hopefully you've enjoyed this presentation. And if you have questions on, you know, any of these things that you heard or questions on how to join an advisor board, you know, feel free, ping. You have quite some time left. We have 25 minutes left. So go ahead. Any questions? Any? Okay, go ahead. Sorry, you mean Prism?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question was, can we use Prism for ASP.NET applications? And do you also mean ASP.NET MVC or just ASP.NET?
Just ASP.NET.
Okay, well, so the problem is Prism is really focusing on WPF and Silverlight. There is guidance on how to do, you know, more modular development in web development. It's not the last web guidance project, it's the one before that, where they're explaining, okay, how do you do stuff like modular application development when building web applications? So the guidance is there, it's just not Prism. There's like a part framework around that, how to use, you know, dependency injection within building web applications. It was also done for SharePoint guidance, which is, you know, kind of related to that, where we try to build, you know, also a modular system with, you know, hooking things up using, you know, dependency injection and all. In SharePoint, it was a lot more difficult to do, and with regular, you know, ASP.NET MVC, it's quite a lot simpler actually to get that to work. Some of the pieces from it, for example, the event aggregator, you could probably use to do certain things. So, any other questions? Well, I'll be here for a while. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and I hope you liked the presentation. There's going to be another presentation tomorrow on Windows Azure Enterprise Library Integration Pack. It's going to be a lot of fun. So we're going to go much deeper into code then.